Accession number 19913, Reel 4.
Ashley Cunningham, Booth, Reel 4.
I can remember one incident which says a lot about the relationships called comradeship and friendship in the front line. And there's nothing in civilian life to compare with it. And I remember this friend who was one of my best friends. I got myself into the back of a 1500 weight truck. And so I was creeping along in this convoy that wasn't going anywhere really, because of the hundreds of troops that were filling the road trying to get out. And interview came this dear friend of mine, and he looked absolutely grim. I later discovered that he'd survived the battle by pretending to be dead when his position was overrun. And of course he was fortunate, because the Chinese often shot the bodies as they went by, the wounded. And then to eventually get out, he realised that all those that were clinging onto the tanks, the wounded, were being hacked to death by the Chinese that were all along the main supply route, both sides, in the drainage ditches, monsoon ditches. And, you know, you could literally put your hand out and touch the wounded. So, of course, they were, all those that were exposed on the top of the tanks, they got terrible wounds, or were killed. So this friend of mine, Ted, he went behind the tank, and of course all the dirt and filth and dust was churned up, and he was disguised in that, and that's how he got out. So by the time I saw him, he was in a filthy state, but he was also absolutely wrecked, he was. And I said to him, "Ted, for Christ's sake, you know, what's up, lad?" He said, "My feet are killing me." And apparently the boots that we were originally went to Korea with were from the Norwegian campaign, and they rotted, and the QM hadn't got his size of boot, so he gave him a size too large, and the boots were crippling him. So I took off mine, because we wore the same size boots, I took off mine and gave him mine. And the expression of gratitude and relief, I can still see measured on his face today. And if I never did another act of friendship with this one man, I would be his eternal friend. Regrettably, he died, like all too many of my friends. I think that's the hardest part of war, is losing your friends. Very difficult to live with. And you, you know, all this glory business, all this for king, queen, the flag, doesn't mean a thing. It's them or you. It's down to that. And when you've lost a friend, all you want is to kill as many as you can, by way of revenge. For example, one of our ambulances at the Imjin was shot up by the Chinese, and they killed all the wounded inside. And when we came across that, straight away the word went out, no prisoners. So there were no prisoners taken by my battalion after that incident.
Where was that?
That was on the Imjim. That's a well-known account, that is, that ambulance. All fusiliers will remember that.
How many men did it involve?
Well, you can get quite a few in an ambulance, not only on your stretchers, but crouched. There'd probably be about 14 blokes in there. There was an incident between Happy Valley and the MGM. I'm sure it was, at that time. I stand corrected. But it's a well-known incident that was investigated by United Nations. And that was the murder of the execution of the South Korean civilians, which included old men, women and kids. And I was an eyewitness to that.
How did you come to be an eyewitness?
Well, the choice of execution ground was in the area that was occupied by my battalion. And they came along led by a Canadian major from the the Judge Advocates Department, and he was the one that was going to, if you like, placate any opposition to the executions.
Play what?
To placate any opposition to, by people like ourselves, to the execution of the civilians, which was all done by Koreans. What they made them do, they dug a trench, made them dig their own grave, shot them in the back of the head, and some of them were not killed. Then they brought along a second party, lined them up, and shot them. And they did that three times. And in the end, when they came the next day to do it again, we decided enough was enough. And we stopped the party. We fixed bayonets. There wasn't many of us. But, regrettably, the officer that was in the party that I was with, he died. He became a friend of mine, a chap called Schofield. And my particular boss was older in Quartermaster Sergeant Brown, and he was chosen to go to Tokyo and give his personal account of the atrocity to a United Nations commission. I made a statement, but I wasn't called to give evidence. All those that were there, that were eyewitnesses, we all made a statement.
Where and when was this?
Now, I can't give you a location, because it was one of those in the middle of nowhere. You know, it wasn't in a well-known place. It wasn't in a town or a city.
But how soon after you arrived in Korea was that? So
now I have difficulty with gaps. I have big gaps in my recall,
don't worry too much. Anyway, it'll be on record.
Yes, it is a matter of record.
And how many people were carrying out the executions?
Oh, can't put a number to that, but a substantial number.
How many were being executed?
Oh, I think they killed about 300. I think they killed about 300.
What were they using as weapons?
Pistols. pistols, mostly pistols.
What was the reaction of the people who were being executed?
Incredibly passive, as though resigned to their fate.
Were the RNF people shouting?
No, I can't remember that. I think the protest really took place the next day when we talked about it, and we'd seen that what we were unhappy about was we claimed that there were youngsters, young kids, among those that were executed. You see, in the state of things in Korea at that time, if you had a son that was a deserter and your son went home and you harboured him, as you would, you were executed for harbouring a deserter. If you stole military supplies, and little kids did a lot of that, that's the way they survived. And of course, if they got caught, they were executed. And what offended us more than anything else was the fact they were old and young.
How near to you did it happen?
Oh, I should think within 50 yards.
Near to a camp of yours?
Not a camp in the sense of a camp, but in positions that we were occupying.
You mean slit trenches?
Yes.
In open country?
Yes. Yes.
And what was the Canadian doing?
Well, he was there, if you like, saying, "Well, this is authorised. Their executions are approved by the government of South Korea, we can't interfere with that process." But in fact, on the next day, this officer that I told you about, Schofield, pulled a pistol out and said to the major, "You take it beyond this point and I'll shoot you."
So the same thing was going to happen the next day?
Oh, yes. Yes, they brought them along again. Another party. In trucks. And as they disembarked, the old Canadian major came along and we were sort of blocking their progress. And he said, you know, you can't interfere with this process. It's authorised by the government of South Korea. And old Schofield pulled his pistol out and said, "I can, and I will, and I'll shoot you."
What was the outcome?
Well, they backed off. They went off, but they probably killed him somewhere else.
And you were there with a weapon?
Oh, yes, I was there.
With what?
Stun gun.
Would you have used it?
Yes, I would, yeah.
Now, if we can come back to the retreat from the Imjin, can you tell me what happened to you afterwards, please?
Afterwards, yeah. Well, afterwards, we pulled back to Seoul. And we were in the grounds of Seoul University. And I have to tell you that there are more bodies buried or half buried in the grounds of Seoul University than anywhere else I'd witnessed in Korea. You could barely move for bodies, buried and unburied. Incredible. And I remember when we talk about the brutalizing process, I remember that I'd moved into these positions quite late on in the day, and what I had to do when we moved into a new position, I had to set up the command post. And what we did, we had a 15 underweight with canvas coming back from the truck. So we had to dig out the ground so that you can have people standing up. You got the truck on the high ground, given the height, and we dig out a wedge and tent the rest of the area, and that became the command post. Now, we did this three times in one day, and by the time I'd finished, I got blisters on my hands, and I was absolutely shattered, and there was no way I was going to dig a hole for myself. So I simply threw a ground sheet on the ground and tossed and turned all night, because I got a stone under my back, and I was so exhausted I didn't want to shift off the position, so all I was doing was moving my body. And in the morning I moved the ground sheet and I kicked the stone, and it was not a stone, it turned out to be the foot of a Chinaman I'd been sleeping on.
A Chinaman?
Yes.
How did you know he was Chinese?
Because of his footwear. You know, they had like paddy boots.
You mean a Chinese soldier?
Yes. And so I pulled his trouser leg, pulled his leg, and the bones dropped out of his leg, trouser leg. So I went to the other end and dug his head up. And we played football with it for an hour.
What for?
We hadn't got a ball. And eventually I stuck I had a little American pup tent. A two-man pup tent, which the Americans had in plentiful supply, and we didn't have anything like it. And I'd grabbed one of these from the Americans. And I stuck this skull on top of the tent. I've got a photograph of it upstairs somewhere. And I can remember the adjutant coming along and saying, if they come and they find that bloody head there, they'll have your head on it. So I discarded it. But I planned to bring it back to the UK. Because, you know, that's the way my head went in those days. You know, I was totally brutalised by the war.
But were all these corpses in the university grounds Chinese?
I should imagine there were both elements, you know, Chinese and South Koreans, because they'd done some fierce fighting there.
So they were battle casualties?
Oh yes, battle casualties, yes. Yeah.
And so this was immediately after the Imjin battle?
Yes, that was our first fallback position by the Han River. And from that point on, I have got very poor recollection of events to the time of Operation Commando.
What was that?
That was the last battle, which was not really intended for my brigade or any component part of my brigade. It was 25th Commonwealth Brigade, which was partly Oz, Canadian and British. But apparently my new CO, the second in command, had been promoted, had been approached and asked if he would let our battalion participate in Operation Commando. Now, I believe, quite honestly, that if Colonel Foster had survived the Imjin, he would have said no. We had more battles than any other British battalion in the Korean War, and enough was enough, and we were all ready to go home. Not home, to be posted out of the theatre. In fact, some of the reservists I'd actually got a date for sailing. That's how close we were to it. And but the new commanding officer for whatever reason, agreed to the battalion participating. We lost some terrible casualties at Operation Commando.
What did you see of it yourself?
I was a spectator, I'm pleased to tell you. Yes, I didn't actually fight in that particular battle.
But you were watching at a distance?
Yes.
What could you see there?
Oh, a very determined attempt by my old company again, W Company, who suffered quite substantial casualties in the first assault. And they actually went up this hill three times in one day. And I don't know where they found the, you know, the guts to do it. Incredible. And I'm just pleased that I wasn't involved in it. Because the Chinese were there in well-established positions, defence positions, and we were going up the front door, so to speak. Australians and Canadians went up the back way, got very little opposition.
And this was the last battle you witnessed in Korea?
Yes, Operation Commando, November 1951.
Just going back to Happy Valley, you had mentioned just in passing that you saw the rocks retreating in Happy Valley.
Yeah.
What exactly did you see of that?
Well, this whole battalion of troops running like the clappers to get out. Now, I can remember Colonel Foster having the officer commanding the Rock Battalion brought to him. I don't know the circumstance of that, of course. And through an interpreter, Colonel Foster told the CO of the Rock Battalion that he'd got to get his men back and face up to the, you know, the task of fighting the enemy. Or he was going to shoot him personally. The Rock Battalion did reappear, but I can't. I've got no recollection of what their performance was like.
Did you feel any hatred towards the enemy in Korea?
Yes. Recently, a man that I know very well, who was, who became General Secretary of the BKVA, you probably interviewed him, Sam Mercer.
Yes, I have.
Well, an article recently appeared in the Sun newspaper, which was sent to me by a friend of mine, in which he shows Sam with a bloody headline that says, "If I could meet the soldier, the enemy soldier that shot me on the Indian, I'd shake his hand." Well, you know, what a load of rubbish. If I could meet the guy, I'd rip his arm off and shove it up his rice bag. That's the difference between Sam and I.
Why should there be a difference between you?
Well, I don't know why there should be a difference, but I think my attitude is probably the attitude of most of my contemporaries. I've spoken to several of my regimental comrades, and we're all agreed that Sam really is talking a load of rubbish.
Did the political aspect of the war make any impact on you at all? Did it mean anything to you?
No, none whatsoever. None whatsoever. In fact, the general consensus of opinion amongst many of my regiment was, what the hell are we doing here? You know, and the idea that we were there to defend the principles of the Charter of the United Nations didn't mean a thing. And it certainly didn't represent a good enough reason to be shot. So, and the fact that the Koreans themselves were not prepared in the early days to fight as well as we'd have expected, We got a very rigid view of things.
So you just went because you were sent?
Yes, and in my case, I volunteered because all my friends were going. And I just seemed to have I was always volunteering for one thing or another, so just seemed the natural thing to do. So I don't regret the experience, you understand? I don't. In fact, I've written extensively on the Korean War, and I would not have been able to have done that without that experience.
Why don't you regret it then?
Well, I don't have any regrets. I think I have to say that I discovered within my makeup an unpleasant part of me that enjoyed certain aspects of the war.
What did you enjoy about it?
Oh, I enjoyed killing people. That was a good feeling. In fact, one of the strongest impressions I have is that when a battle is over, and you're sitting there having a mug of tea and a cigarette, and you're exchanging your experiences, and the honesty that you find in that brief moment of time is incredible, because none of you are trying to impress, you're just simply relating your experiences of how you cope with a battle. And if I could only have recorded that, and I could only have captured it. See, I maintained a diary, which was illegal. I maintained a diary during the Korean War, and I gave it to some bloody idiot from Hull to get back to this country, and he jumped it. I paid him good money as well. But that recorded a lot of my experiences, a lot of my inner feelings, and in some ways explained why I behaved the way I did, and explained my thoughts. It might appear to one who has not been in a war situation, it might appear that if you like, extraordinary, but to me it was not extraordinary, it was just natural to be the way I was, because that's the way most of the men that I soldiered with were. We were there to kill the enemy, and we did it.
But what was in it which would have appeared extraordinary to someone like myself?
Oh, the fact that there was a degree of enjoyment in it, for me anyway. Yeah, there's a great... the adrenaline rush and the sense of having been in a major battle and survived. It's a shot like nothing, and I imagine that even cocaine, whatever that is like, couldn't vie with it for experience. So I would imagine it's a bit like having been a gladiator who's been in the arena